Hey, Prime members, you can listen to CBS Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Life is short, and it's full of a lot of interesting questions. What does happiness really mean? How do I get the most out of my time here on Earth? And what really is the best cereal? These are the questions I seek to resolve on my weekly podcast, Life is Short with Justin Long. Follow Life is Short wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.
Good morning. I'm Jane Pauley, and this is Sunday Morning. More than 15 million Americans hold hunting licenses. The practice goes back to the very roots of our country and is part of a lifestyle often passed down from generation to generation. Some hunt for sport, but a common theme among many is eat what you kill. It's considered the honorable, even the ethical, thing to do. And by one estimate, 95% of all hunters do just that. Lee Cowan hits the trail with one of the biggest names in the sport, a hunter with the skills of a top chef.
So that's dinner tonight?
Yeah, that's a piece of elk meat.
As the creator of the popular reality show Meat Eater, Steve Rinella is a professional hunter. But in that same capacity, he's also a passionate conservationist.
I've never encountered in my life a person who holds wild game in high regard, who doesn't hold wildlife in high regard.
A man living off the land, but also for the land. Later on Sunday Morning.
Tracy Smith sits down with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, two old friends, together again in a new film that's sure to reach new heights.
It's tomorrow I'm going to wake up and I'll be 50. And I'll still be doing it.
They're one of Hollywood's most dynamic duos.
A rookie.
Yes.
Who's never set foot on an NBA court.
That's the literal definition of rookie. Yeah.
And now Ben Affleck and Matt Damon have a new film about Nike sneakers and a new perspective.
There's nothing more that I want in my life. I thought, well, this is it. And then I thought, that might mean I'm about to die.
Guys, I literally had the same thought.
Matt and Ben, like, comfortable, well, like an old shoe, coming up on Sunday Morning.
Anthony Mason is on Broadway with Josh Groban for what you might call a razor-sharp revival.
You grow warm in my hand, my friend.
A new demon barber of Fleet Street has set up shop on Broadway.
Do you have a razor back there?
You're a risk taker, Anthony. I never leave home without one.
Josh Groban and Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd ahead on Sunday Morning.
And more. Connor Knighton takes us to snowy Wisconsin and the biggest cross-country ski race in the country. Rita Braver profiles NPR's Ari Shapiro, a journalist with some serious singing chops. Martha Teichner has the story of one of our oldest black towns struggling to survive. We'll have commentaries on the power of the unspoken word, and the power of Jim Gaffigan to, well, lull you to sleep. All that and more this Sunday morning, the 19th of March, 2023. We'll be back after this. He's a lifelong hunter, wildlife conservationist, and a serious chef. Lee Cowan goes on the hunt with the meat eater.
I got him. He's in the trees.
Here in the Sawtooth Mountains of Idaho, it took just moments for Steve Rinella and his bow hunting buddy Dan to spot some pronghorn antelope off in the brush.
It's laying in the shade.
It took them far less time, however, to realize that having me tag along was a really dumb idea.
What kind of shot is that like for a bow?
Undoable.
I'd never hunted a day in my life, and yet there he was, with perhaps one of the most recognizable hunters in all America.
Like, I do what I was born to do.
Yeah.
And it's this kind of stuff, right? It's just what I like.
Steve Rinella is the creator and host of the popular TV and web series Meat Eater.
You got him?
Now,
run.
In its 11th season. It's hunting the way the hunter sees it, up close and personal. And for Rinella, hunting is personal.
At my core, I like nature. I like hunting. I like fishing. I like eating the stuff that I hunt and fish for. And I turned that into the work I do.
He came to hunting the way most people do. His father hunted. Back then, he saw it largely just as a sport.
When I was 18, I was obsessed with hunting and fishing. I did not know nor use the word conservation. In my mind, all the resources we enjoyed, they fell from the sky. They were there for the taking.
And they would always fall from the sky.
Get yours while the getting's good.
But today, conservation is at the heart of almost everything Meat Eater does.
This valley is like so beautiful I could cry.
The quality of the hunting, he says, is only as good as the health of the population being hunted, be it deer, fish, or anything else. His point is that loving the wild, while still taking a wild animal's life, are not mutually exclusive.
I've never encountered in my life a person who holds wild game in high regard, who doesn't hold wildlife in high regard. And they understand that there's a limit on how much we can pull from it, where we end up dismantling and destroying the whole thing.
Whether you agree with that or not, it's nothing new. Charles Darwin, Ernest Hemingway, John James Audubon, all love nature and hunting. And then there's Theodore Roosevelt, who especially loved the land.
He saved about 50,000 acres of mountains, plains, woodlands in this country for every day he was in office. Why? He was inspired to do that through a relationship with hunting.
That same idea, respecting the resource, is what he's trying to teach his own children. And in part, he's doing that through food.
So that's dinner tonight?
Yeah, that's a piece of elk meat.
At his home in Bozeman, Montana, Rinello's refrigerator is stocked with the frozen spoils of his adventures in the wild.
Elk meat, ducks, wild turkey.
Everything in here, he says, has a story that brings with it a discussion.
Every night that we eat something that we grew, that we hunted, that we found out in the woods, that we found in our backyard, every night. And there's not a night goes by, I'm not kidding, there's not a night goes by that we don't talk about it.
We'll flip that in a minute, but.
His cooking has attracted non-hunting viewers as well.
Man, those sons of guns are good.
Rinella has become the Julia Child of the campfire. The last third of almost every Meat Eater episode is cooking the day's catch or kill in ways that make the woods look like a 3-star Michelin restaurant.
I'm going to slice up my loin and prepare a very simple stag and pumpkin stew.
I've read this story dozens of times. It'd be like shock, like, wow, this chef, this famous chef, whatever name your famous chef, has become interested in hunting. I'm like, of course he is, because the guy's, he's interested in food.
He's not trying to convince animal rights advocates, for example, to suddenly become hunters themselves.
First turkey.
Thanks, Steve.
But what he hopes anyone who is interested in the show will come away with is the notion that hunters aren't always the enemies of animal welfare.
I'm talking to my kind. By that I mean I'm talking to other like outdoors men and outdoors women. I'm also talking to people who are like kicking the tires on this world, who are curious about it. If they weren't curious, they wouldn't be watching.
Meat Eater has now grown into having a lifestyle brand, clothes and products for hunting. He's written a number of best-selling books, including cookbooks, and he has a top-rated podcast as well.
Like a black bear, right? She's going to spend 2 years tutoring her offspring.
His brand is based on a singular philosophy that none of us live on the land. We live with it.
You get to a point where you just have to give up and go home. The land beat you, or the sheep beat you, just by running out the clock.
Back in Idaho, suffice it to say that that pronghorn didn't care much for my nagging questions.
It's already tuned in, like I was sitting here yakking away.
But for Steve Rinella, that's okay. What he likes most of all is showing his world to those experiencing it anew.
Yeah.
And watching it through the eyes of people who have never seen it, quite the way he does.
It's looking right at us.
At least not yet.
Wow. Isn't that cool? And there's another one.
It's part ski marathon, part Norwegian history, part street festival. Connor Knighton takes us to the starting line of a race like none other.
Berkey fever, got me here as a beaver. Got me waiting for winter, got me praying for snow. Berkey fever, I'm a true believer. Just get me to the start line, I'll be ready to go.
We're underway!
Each winter, thousands of cross-country skiers from all across the world travel to the North Woods of Wisconsin to travel more than 30 miles between the towns of Cable and Hayward. The American Birkebeiner is the largest cross-country ski race in the country, and the enthusiasm here is contagious.
We all got the Berkey fever, and it's just the excitement that builds about not only the race, but the whole event of Berkey Week.
The official Birkebeiner race, Berkey for short, can fly by in a couple of hours for the most elite skiers. But leading up to the main event, there are days of activities. There are shorter races for children. There's a Barkey, where dog lovers ski with their pets. Teams of six compete in giant ski races.
It's kind of like Comic-Con for athletes is how I'm looking at it.
Jackie and Dan DeRoma are avid skiers. Jackie has skied the Berkey 4 times, Dan 17. But for this year's race, they wanted to do things a little differently.
These other racers are going to be in spandex, Gore-Tex, you know. Yep. What are you going to be wearing?
Full on fur.
Jackie, Dan, and Dan's father, Jim, were selected to be mascots of sorts, skiing the entire course on wooden skis, dressed as Norwegian folk heroes, all while carrying a baby doll. It's a tradition with roots in a far older history.
Inga, hey, vi tar vare på ham. Du har mitt ord.
As portrayed in the film The Last King, in the early 13th century, Norway was in the middle of a civil war. After King Håkon III died, members of the Birkebeiner faction skied his son, the heir to the throne, through the woods to safety. Each year in Wisconsin, three skiers reenact the rescue.
I think the fact that there is this real story about an event that now you're recreating it, I think that's pretty darn cool and pretty special, and I think it resonates with a lot of people.
Ben Popp is the executive director of the American Birkebeiner, which is modeled after a Norwegian race. There, every competitor skis with a baby weight backpack to honor the warrior's journey. Of course, you may be asking yourself,
why is this crazy Norwegian history have anything to do with Hayward, Wisconsin, in the middle of northwestern Wisconsin? Nowhere. It all came down to one man, Tony Wise.
Tony Wise was born in Hayward and was a born marketer. After serving in World War II, he decided to bring the competitive skiing he observed in Europe back home to Wisconsin, a place where Scandinavian ancestry is common, as a way to encourage tourism. His first Berkey race, held 50 years ago, had just 35 participants, most of whom had never cross-country skied before.
I swore up and down after that first I would never do anything so foolish again, but...
And they're off, ladies and gentlemen.
Today, at age 75, Ernie St. Germain is the only competitor who's participated in every single race. But there are more than 2,000 athletes who have appeared in 20 or more contests, which can turn into grueling all-day endeavors. The Berkey attracts skiers of varying ages and ability levels.
You're really going to discover who you are. It's one of the toughest marathon courses in the world.
So let yourself kind of glide a little. There you go. Good.
That challenge is what attracts elite skiers like Olympian Caitlin Gregg, who's won the women's race a record-setting 5 times.
The Berkey course is unlike any other ski course that we get to race, not only here in the United States, but also around the world. And I think that its terrain is so unique and so challenging that people just, myself included, love that aspect of it.
The race itself has faced challenges posed by warmer winters. In recent decades, it's been canceled twice due to lack of snow.
It's really important that we look at climate change and weather, because if we don't have it, well, it's a big loss.
The event provides a major boost for the local economy. This town of fewer than 3,000 residents hosts close to 40,000 spectators. On race day, Hayward's Main Street overflows with cheering fans caught up in Berkey fever, for which the only prescription is more cowbell. The church bells signal the arrival of the first finisher. David Norris won this year's men's race with a commanding lead. Caitlin Gregg came in 3rd in the women's division. But the biggest cheers of the day were reserved for the Doromas. Nearly 7 hours after leaving the starting line, they skied onto Main Street and swapped out the baby doll for an actual baby.
We're gonna save you today.
Their daughter Clara played the part of Prince Hokan for the final few blocks. The Birkebeiners saved the day. Until they do it all again next year.
The musical Sweeney Todd is back on Broadway with Josh Groban in the title role. For Anthony Mason, their meeting was a chance to sit back, if not relax.
You actually took barber lessons for this?
I did. I wanted the shaving community, should they come to this show, to be really impressed.
He's the new demon barber of Fleet Street.
Do you have a razor back there?
You're a risk taker, Anthony. I never leave home without one.
And Josh Groban just learned how to give a close shave.
We would start with the neck, maybe, and then we would turn and we would do your cheek this way.
Is there an art to the decisive stroke?
You know, I'm just winging it. You know, it's really just, this is where the improvisation of theater comes in. I've never given anybody an actual, like, sharp razor shave, so, you know. We've enjoyed you on television for a long, long time.
Thank you so
much.
And
I want to thank you so much for spending
your final
day with us here. That's right. captured in high def.
Speak to me, friend. In Sweeney Todd, whisper, I'll listen. The new Broadway revival of Stephen Sondheim's iconic musical.
At last, my right arm is complete again.
Most of his customers don't survive.
You're not known for playing evil.
No, I'm not, which is part of the fun.
Did you come in for a pie, sir? Do forgive me if me had a little vague.
As Sweeney, Groban has a co-conspirator. Anna Lee Ashford plays Mrs. Lovett. Heaven knows I tried,
sir. On the top, she's just a bubbling, bubbling, bubbling little pot of magic. And underneath, it's a stew that's extremely complicated.
And I've got some shepherd's pie peppered with actual shepherd on top.
Mrs. Lovett sweetly disposes of Sweeney's victims in her meat pies.
No will serve anyone, meaning anyone, and to anyone at all.
You know, when you're playing Iago, you don't know you're the bad guy.
That's right.
And so that's always sort of the way that I've viewed Mrs. Lovett. Yeah. She doesn't think she's bad. She's surviving. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Lovett, at her core, is a survivor.
Yes.
And she needs Sweeney Todd because she's a woman in a man's world.
Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street. The original 1979 production, which starred Angela Lansbury as Mrs. Lovett.
My surprise!
And Len Carreyrou as Sweeney, won 8 Tonys. The unlikely inspiration for the musical was a dark Victorian melodrama, but Sondheim thought it could sing.
you know, the elevator pitch to something like this, you know, in 1977, you know, would have been like, well, have fun with that, Steve. You know, enjoy.
Good luck.
I'll never forget when Tommy Cale told me at an ice hockey game, you know, you should really come to this workshop I'm doing. It's about Alexander Hamilton, and it's a hip-hop musical. And is it a comedy? And I'm kind of, you know, say, good luck with that, you know? Can't wait to see it. I'm sure it'll be great.
Is there a lot of expectation, do you think, with this show?
You tell me.
Thomas Cale, the Tony-winning director of Hamilton, is now directing Sweeney Todd.
You directed the best-known show on Broadway right now, right over there. How does this compare to that?
This was a huge source of inspiration. This was a show about a misunderstood person, and the world was trying to figure out why he did what he did.
Yeah.
The show on the other side of 46th Street
yeah.
doesn't happen unless there's Sweeney Todd.
I know why nobody cares to take them. I should know. I like them. The good now.
The comic relief in Sweeney comes with a Cockney accent.
It's not easy.
No, it's like speaking another language.
Aren't you also, would you like a drop of ale?
Ashford got tips from the show's British choreographer.
Every once in a while, he'd be like, it's budge. It's budge, not budge. Budge. You know, I'm like standing backstage going, budge, 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 budge. My little boy hates it. He's like, will you please stop doing your British accent? And I'm just not.
Accident.
I'm just not correcting him because I think it's too delightful.
You want a painter, poet, sculptor, preferably marble, granite, bronze, durable.
I have a 6.5-year-old little boy. The last time I was on stage doing 8 shows a week, he was not even 6 months old.
Which so also must have been really hard.
It was really challenging. I was nursing.
Yeah.
I'd run off after act one, an intermission pump. It was just like, it was just all about milk. 8 shows a week in milk.
The last time Groban was doing 8 shows a week, the singer was making his Broadway debut nearly 7 years ago in Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812.
How much did you like that experience?
It's the happiest I've ever been in my career.
Really?
Yeah. I was a theater kid that hit a fork in the road when I found my way into the music biz. That was not something that I had dreams of in my bedroom when I was 10 years old. Yeah. It was this.
Now you're shine. It was Groban's manager who suggested he play Sweeney.
And I'm thinking to myself, oh, I'm not old enough to do that. And he's like, dude, you're going to be 41. I'm like, oh my God, that is old enough.
That's so nice of you. Thank you. Oh my gosh.
You shouldn't have.
He turned 42 the day we spoke with him.
Thank you.
Happy birthday, dear Josh. Happy birthday to you.
You have the voice of an angel.
No.
Has anybody ever told you that?
No.
It's beautiful.
See how they glisten.
The production had its first run-through a year and a half ago.
And Sondheim was going to be there. He was excited. And 2 days before we were to do that run-through, he passed away.
Did you think at first in that moment that this wasn't going to happen then?
Well, it was a lot of conflicting emotions because the first one, of course, was just grief.
Sondheim had been a fan of The Great Comet, and they'd become friends.
He said to me when we hung out once, I'm not going to tell you when I come to the show. I'm going to do you that solid. I said,
Thank you,
Steve. And then, of course, at intermission, you know, the group text is, red alert, red alert. The maestro is in the building, you know.
In the end, Groban and company went ahead with Sweeney Todd to honor Sondheim. And also because the star clearly enjoys giving a close shave.
You lean him back and then you send him
back,
down the slide.
I lean him back and then there's a third lever that sends him down. It's already fun.
In the decades after the Civil War, an estimated 100 all-black towns were settled across the United States, most are long gone. But Martha Teichner visits one of the first and last that's still fighting to hold on.
It's only the telling that makes sense of these old photos of Eatonville, Florida. And the great teller of Eatonville's story was anthropologist and noted writer Zora Neale Hurston, who grew up here.
Joe Clark's store was the heart and spring of the town. Men sat around the store on boxes and benches and passed this world and the next one through their mouths.
Third-generation Eatonville resident N.Y. Nathiri heads the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community.
Joe Clark is which one?
Standing at the left. Joe Clark was the mayor and actually the founder of the town of Eatonville.
In 1887, that it even happened was remarkable. After the end of the Civil War, formerly enslaved African Americans flocked to Central Florida to work. White property owners refused to sell them land until Joe Clark convinced two white Northerners with homes in the area, Lewis Lawrence and Josiah Eaton, to make available plots they could buy in what became Eatonville, one of the first black towns to incorporate.
There was a lot of resistance from the surrounding communities because if they could incorporate, that meant that they could vote, they could have their own law enforcement, they could manage their own business.
Everett Fly is a landscape architect who has spent more than four decades researching black towns.
By 1915, there are less than 60 incorporated black towns in the entire United States.
How many of those 60 are left?
I think probably 20, 25 is all that's left. More than 90% of it is about racism. It's everything from, oh, it's not important, or they won't know the difference if we move them out or erase them. No one's going to do anything.
Eatonville today is struggling. The median income here, around $27,000 a year. This Family Dollar is the only store. There's no supermarket, no gas station, no pharmacy.
So many of the black towns have disappeared. What's different about Eatonville?
What we have the ability to do here is to leverage the genius of Zora Neale Hurston and the authenticity of Eatonville as a cultural and historical space.
Zora tourism exists already.
Just enjoy the Zora Festival.
The Zora Festival, Nathiri's preservation group puts on every year before COVID, regularly attracted over 50,000 people. Fewer now. But Eatonville would like to leverage something else. This land, 100 acres, 10 minutes from downtown Orlando, half an hour from Disney World, valued at more than $20 million in 2019, certainly worth much more now.
As a small community of 2,500, it's sitting on the largest undeveloped parcel of land in Orange County. It's sitting in a very sweet position geographically.
Nathiri's opinion, Eatonville's survival will depend on who wins the fight over this land, which is as closely tied to its past as it is to its future. The trouble is, the town doesn't own it and never has.
This is an insult. This is an insult. No trespassing, keep out.
Once, it was part of a 300-acre campus that occupied about 40% of Eatonville. The land was donated by philanthropists to a trust which operated the Robert Hungerford Normal and Industrial School, a private boarding school established in 1899 to provide vocational education to black students in the segregated South.
This is when I was in high school. I was voted May Day Queen.
By the time Vera King went there, it was a black public school.
This looks like one of the original boarding school
buildings.
It is.
We had classes in that building.
In 1951, the Orange County School Board bought Hungerford from the trust that owned it. For a little over $16,000, the school board got all 300 acres, but with this important restriction. The land still had to be used for the education of black children.
This is me at Hungerford.
For 30 years, Vera King worked at the high school that was built on the site.
Now it's gone too, along with 200 of those 300 acres.
If we aren't careful, Eatonville is going to be extinct.
King, 85 years old, an Eatonville native, resents what happened when the Orange County Public Schools started selling off parcel after parcel of the Hungerford property, getting the courts and the trustees again and again to cut the number of acres required to be used for educating black kids. So now it's zero.
They really profited from it, from those sales.
The Orange County school system was paid nearly $8 million in those deals.
You have hashtag land back on your sleeve.
Yes. Nobody has made enough noise, and nobody has demanded the land back.
Julian Johnson isn't the only Eatonville resident who thinks the Orange County Public Schools ought to just give the land to Eatonville as a kind of restitution.
This is economic justice that we're fighting for. Land is economic justice. It's about demanding it back. You've done the people wrong over and over.
So, with those last 100 acres set to be sold on March 31st to a developer, for $14 million, well below their last appraised value.
I'm from Eatonville.
Johnson helped to mobilize for a showdown.
The streets are talking, the people are talking, and the people are angry and furious.
The only control Eatonville has over what gets built is through its zoning and planning. Last month, the town council met to vote on changes that would clear the way for this, a new community of more than 350 homes and apartments.
Once the project is built out, it'll offer shopping, dining, entertainment options for residents and visitors to partake and enjoy.
The packed room didn't see it that way.
Quite simply, this development will erase this living, thriving, historical community.
For y'all to come and put all this stuff up here and think we as black people gonna be able to stay here, shame on yourself.
We're gonna be outnumbered. And I want you guys to vote no.
They did. But the developer can still buy the site and build, so long as it's something consistent with Eatonville's vision for the town's survival. In a statement to Sunday Morning, the Orange County Public School System reaffirmed its commitment to go ahead with the sale. No word yet from the developer. For Eatonville residents, a lawsuit may be next. A last stand in a losing war? Not if they can help it.
This is sacred land. It's special for us. It's who we are. And we're not going to let them take it away from us. No.
Jim Gaffigan's impressive resume reads, comedian, actor, writer, and producer. Now he's adding another title, sleep aid.
When I was a little kid, yeah, that's what I look like. When I was a little kid, to enjoy stand-up comedy, you either needed to know someone whose parents owned comedy albums.
I think it's wrong that only one company makes the game Monopoly.
Or you had to stay up until after the local news and hope that Johnny Carson had a stand-up comedian on The Tonight Show.
We've got some great guests, though.
Often I fell asleep during the news. Remember when the news was boring?
Commuters who work in Chicago.
Yes, I grew up a long time ago. I just look like I'm in my 20s. For decades, stand-up comedy has been accessible everywhere. Cable TV, satellite radio, Netflix, Amazon, YouTube, on all the social media platforms. It's a good thing, and it's changed many comedians' lives and allowed me to be the mediocre father of too many children. People can discover comedians they enjoy and immediately listen to that comedian. It's a win-win for everyone. Now, recently, I've noticed a trend that is, well, I think is odd. On more than one occasion, I've been told, often by a stranger, my 10-year-old son listens to you to fall asleep. My kids listen to you as a nighttime ritual. Your stand-up helps my teenager at bedtime. I'm always like, okay, These comments are always presented as a compliment, but I'm never sure how to respond to being used as a sleep aid.
When I go out to eat, if I order a salad, the waiter's always like, "Aww."
It doesn't feel flattering to be told you're the human equivalent of warm milk. I've never been considered an edgy comedian, but I've constantly aspired to get laughs, not snores. Anyway, next time you can't sleep, don't count sheep, just say, "Hey, play Jim Gaffigan."
When you have kids, you lie to them all the time. You're like, "You wouldn't like this ice cream. It's very spicy."
Stop rushing me back.
Stop crowding the plane.
Ben Affleck and Matt Damon made movie history with Good Will Hunting some 25 years ago. Now they're together again in a new film that has them walking on air. They're in conversation with our Tracy Smith.
So is it a bonus making this film, being able to spend more time with each other?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, that's...
For sure.
Was one of the things that we kind of wanted to do is the idea of, like, why aren't we hanging out and spending more time together since we managed to stay friends this whole time?
Plus, we hit our 50s, so... I mean,
we have not much time left.
I mean, you can see the end of the tunnel.
From the sound of it, Ben Affleck and Matt Damon are in a good place these days. They're working together again. And to hear them describe it, they've never had a better time.
Do you guys have an unspoken language?
Yeah, 40-something years of hanging out together.
It's like a common frame of reference, right? I find the most wonderful thing about it was I loved coming to work every day. I loved seeing Matt. I loved, first of all, he's a genius. And having him in your as the anchor of your movie just makes it... I didn't used to think this. But that it just makes it so easy. And it was just so much fun. I don't know, it's kind of felt like just us and getting to do the thing that we wanted to do. I loved it. I miss it every day since. It was the best work experience of my life, without question.
And that experience is Air. Your motor is... The movie, in theaters only on April 5th, is about Nike and how, back in 1984, they built an entire shoe brand around one NBA rookie player they thought would become a household name.
I need the greatest basketball shoe that's ever been made.
Who's the player?
Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan.
I'm willing to bet my career on Michael Jordan. Come on. Man.
Affleck, who's also the film's director, plays Nike founder Phil Knight. And Damon is Sonny Vaccaro, the Nike exec who tries to sell him on the idea.
I mean, if you look at him, if you really look at Jordan, like I did, you're going to see exactly what I see. Which is what? The most competitive guy I have ever seen. He is a f***ing killer.
Is it the shoes?
We now know it turned out to be a killer deal for everyone involved.
You sure it's not the shoes?
The Jordan brand is still flying off the shelves, with sales of more than $5 billion last year alone. The movie is not a biopic, but Affleck made sure everyone looked as close to real as possible, especially Damon.
Did you notice that he lost the weight?
Yeah, so let's talk about that.
My favorite thing about Ben is that he put me in a fat suit when I finally get to work with him. And my wife saw the movie, and I said, "What did you think?" And she goes, "The movie is great. You look like..."
And according to Affleck, Michael Jordan himself had a few suggestions.
What did he tell you was important to him?
A number of things, and I'm not sure that I'm at liberty to share every single one of them. But what I will tell you is he said, "Viola Davis is going to be my mother."
Which is kind of like choosing Michael Jordan for your basketball team.
My name's Sonny Vaccaro. I'm with Nike.
Do you typically make it a habit of showing up at people's front doors unannounced?
I don't like to take no for an answer.
Oh, man. Here we go.
Viola Davis was, in fact, cast as Michael's mom, Dolores Jordan.
Best day of my life.
And Chris Tucker plays and helped write the part of someone he knows personally, Nike VP Howard White.
All that matters is how much do you believe? I believe in you.
I called Chris Tucker, and he was like, who I've always thought was a genius and wanted to work with, and he was like, "I know Howard White." I was like, "You know Howard White?" Turns out later, Chris Tucker knows everybody. Literally everybody.
One person we see very little of is an actor who plays Jordan.
Why do we not see Michael Jordan in this movie?
We don't see Michael Jordan for the very, what was obvious reason to me, which is that this is a movie about an icon, about somebody so meaningful, that the minute, you know, I show you somebody and tell you, like, "Hey, that's Michael Jordan," you just go, "No, it isn't." I know what Michael Jordan is. I know what he is. And not only that, the only actor who could play Michael Jordan was a little old to play this part, and we probably couldn't afford him. But the idea was, like, if I show you something, that you know that's not Michael Jordan, and now everything else is fake.
So the final result feels real. And as always, it was a team effort. Ben Affleck and Matt Damon met as kids in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and clicked from the start, chasing the same Hollywood dream. You might not have caught them in 1989's Field of Dreams as extras somewhere in the crowd in Boston's Fenway Park.
Why you like me now?
But you might have seen them in this.
My boy's wicked smart.
You don't owe it to yourself. You owe it to me. Because tomorrow I'm going to wake up and I'll be 50. And I'll still be doing it.
For Good Will Hunting, both won the Oscar for original screenplay. And it launched them, ready or not, into the Hollywood stratosphere.
What did it do to you guys to win it that young?
I remember it didn't settle in for, it was like a couple years, I think. It was just completely surreal.
March of 98, I was 25 years old.
Yeah.
I look at myself now and think, I still have quite a bit to learn. You know, that's the curse of being 25, is you think you have it all figured out.
Put your hands up!
Of course, they have figured it out. Individually, they've earned everything from box office respect.
Here's your director.
You teach somebody to be a director in a day?
You teach a rhesus monkey to be a director in a day.
To more Oscar gold.
I stood out here in front of you all, really just a kid. And I went out, you know, and I never thought that I would be back here.
Frankly, one of the lessons of growing older is it's not all about money. It's not the most important thing. You spend your life chasing money, you'll end up... You might end up with a lot of money, but you probably miss out on a lot of things. I haven't found that money changed any happiness that I had. In fact, that's the beautiful thing about this is the happiness was being able to be here every day in Los Angeles where my children are and see them every day, have them come visit the set, work with my best friend my whole life. There's nothing more that I want in my life. I thought, well, this is it. This is what I've always wanted, you know? And then I thought, that might mean I'm about to die.
Guys, I literally had the same thought. I was like, this is we've actually reached the mountaintop.
And now, together, they've formed a new production company called Artists Equity that'll give people on the film crew a bigger slice of the financial pie.
That's why it's called Artists Equity, and the idea is that we're pulling a bunch of people above the line who traditionally aren't, and they stand to do a lot better financially than they've ever done on movies before.
I believe in your son. I believe he's the future. And his story is going to make us want to fly. But a shoe is just a shoe.
Until my son steps into it.
You got a name for it?
Air Jordan.
Air is their company's first offering, with more to come soon.
Seriously?
Maybe it'll grow on me.
We're just getting rolling, working again with Amazon to do the story of a wrestler named Anthony Robles, who was born with one leg and won a national championship for Arizona State.
And who's starring in that movie?
I know where you're going with this, but I'm going to tell you who the lead actor is. And,
is there another actor in that movie?
We always hire the very best performers, and in this case, I can say every single person that's been cast so far, I think, is the very absolute best choice.
You're dancing around that Jennifer Lopez is also
I believe Jennifer Lopez may be doing that movie, yes. You're going to make it look like she's just doing it as a favor to me, but actually, she is.
Awkward moment, I saw here. Chris comes in.
It seems fitting that Affleck and Damon's new movie is a story about collaboration. That's what got them here, and what keeps them going.
What fun and what a joy to do something with her, see her be great, go to work with your wife, go to work with your best friend, because ultimately, like, your work becomes what the lion's share of what defines your life in terms of the time you spend. That's who it is. And if you don't like who you're working with, and if you have difficulty or trouble at work, I think it's one of the things that can really cause depression, anxiety, and pain for people. And conversely, if you love the people at work, you probably have a pretty good life, you know?
Commentary now from author Dan Lyons, whose new book is a call to talk less and listen more.
Sooner or later, every person who talks too much talks their way into trouble. You might offend someone or hurt their feelings. You might lose your job or wreck a relationship. I know because I'm an inveterate overtalker. I also know how hard it is to break the habit. That's partly because the propensity to overtalk is wired into your brain, and you can't change that. But also, we live in a world that practically forces you to talk too much. Social media is designed to get you posting, sharing, liking, and commenting. And we have somehow come to believe that success is measured by your ability to attract attention. The founder of a tech company once told me that he determined the value of people by how many Twitter followers they had. That was ridiculous. Look at Steve Jobs. He wasn't on Twitter at all. He had zero followers. What was his value? Zero? In fact, most powerful and successful people talk less than other people, and they listen more. They speak with intention, and they understand the power of silence. Barack Obama is one of the greatest speakers of all time, but he's an even better listener. Richard Branson is a billionaire entrepreneur and a big show-off in public, but in meetings, he mostly takes notes. Anna Wintour is one of the most powerful people in media and fashion, and she is famously quiet. Nobody ever knows what's going on behind those sunglasses. I discovered that in pretty much every aspect of life, talking less gives you an advantage. You might get a promotion or negotiate a better salary. You'll almost certainly be a better parent and partner. The best thing is that you won't just improve your own life. You'll improve the lives of the people around you. There are thousands of books and classes that teach you how to be a better speaker. What we really need to learn is how to shut up.
You may know him as co-host of NPR's All Things Considered. But as Rita Braver reports, Ari Shapiro is a man of many talents.
Ready, Sue?
Yep.
Okay. And hit it.
As a co-host of National Public Radio's flagship evening broadcast.
Open both.
Today is Wednesday, February 15th, and this is All Things Considered from
44-year-old Ari Shapiro is one of the network's highest profile correspondents. What makes a great story for you?
When I'm looking for a great story, I want a point of connection, I want high stakes, and I want a reason somebody should care.
He helps shape coverage.
I noticed that supplemental SNAP benefits for the pandemic end after this month.
Interviews newsmakers.
What does this mean for the future of Scotland and the future of the independence movement?
And he continues to report from the field.
Even though there is still death and fighting in Ukraine's south and east, the scene here at the Polish border has lost.
Yet back when he was a Yale undergraduate.
The truth is, I was rejected for an NPR internship. And I will remind any NPR bosses any time that I was rejected for an NPR internship.
But NPR's legendary legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg chooses her own interns, and she gave him a shot.
He was always willing. Did I have somebody who could go out to the courthouse with a tape recorder and stand there in the pouring rain? Ari Shapiro was there.
After interning, Shapiro was able to get some behind-the-scenes gigs at NPR. But on his off time, he started reporting his own stories.
I decided to treat NPR as a free graduate school. And so I borrowed some equipment, and I asked people if they would teach me how to use it.
What did you find you liked about the reporting part of it?
I'm nosy. You know?
Nosy, and as he relates in his new memoir, The Best Strangers in the World, used to feeling like a bit of an outsider, starting with growing up as one of the few Jews in Fargo, North Dakota, where his parents were professors.
So my older brother and I, we would go from classroom to classroom, carrying a menorah and a dreidel, and we would talk to these children descended from Scandinavian immigrants about what Hanukkah is and what Judaism is.
When Shapiro was 8, the family moved to Portland, Oregon, where he gradually came to another realization. You also describe the fact of coming into the knowledge that you were gay and just feeling pretty comfortable about that from the get-go.
I remember really vividly thinking, the sooner I get this over with, the sooner it'll be a non-issue. So I told my parents, and they took it very well. They said they still loved me. It was a process, but it was a process that we went through together.
And he says that feeling a little like an outsider sharpened his reporting, whether covering the Justice Department, the White House, or spending 2 years as a London-based foreign correspondent.
NPR's Ari Shapiro joins us now from Wales.
White House correspondent Ari Shapiro.
Our co-host Ari Shapiro is there.
Are we all ready?
Shapiro is married to Mike Gottlieb, his college sweetheart. But when they first decided to wed, you thought you needed to ask permission from NPR?
Yeah. 2004 was not that long ago, but in politics, in same-sex marriage, in gay rights, it feels like a lifetime.
What do you think changed in terms of being married to another man and being able to go out there and say, this is my husband?
I think the country kind of caught up to where we were. But I also just became more comfortable in my own skin. And that's part of what this book is about, is my figuring out that the things that differentiate us from one another make us more interesting, more valuable, more rich, and that those are things we should celebrate, not paper over.
Which is why Shapiro now spends his vacations singing with the Portland-based band Pink Martini. Though he'd performed all through high school and college, Shapiro had put music behind him. Then he did a story on the band. A few years later, in 2008, Hink Martini's leader heard Shapiro sing at a party and invited him to record this song for the band's new album.
I'm here to see you. Won't you please, please open the door?
And though he's sung to huge audiences all over the world,
when you say, oh, you're a serious journalist who sings with a band, there is a part of me that still cringes a little bit. And I want to say to myself, Ari, snap out of it. Don't cringe. Be proud.
Really?
You're singing at the Hollywood Bowl. You've sung at Carnegie Hall.
But Pink Martini is not Shapiro's only side hustle.
We'll always be bosom buddies.
He also performs a cabaret act with Tony Award winner Alan Cumming, known for his work in theater, film, and television.
Anything you can sing, I can sing higher. I can sing any note higher. No, you can't. Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
The two had known each other for some time when Cumming pitched the idea to Shapiro.
And I stopped and I turned to him and I said, Alan, don't joke about that because I will absolutely take you up on it.
And then the next morning, I had to sort of call him and say, I still mean it. I still want to do the show with you.
I love you in the morning.
I love you in the morning, yes. I still respect you.
They call the act Och and Oi. He's the Oi, which I get Oi. But what's Och?
Och is sort of a Scottish version of Oi.
He's a Scot.
He's a Jewish boy.
I host a show on NPR.
I'm a top international movie star.
What appeals to you about Ari as a person?
He's so full of zest for life. He's just so interested and fascinated by things. And is a geek, you know, is a big geek. And
but he's kind of a cool geek, right?
I think he's a cool geek. So I think that whatever he does will be truly what he wants to do. And I think he's kind of just finding that out right now.
That's just one of many stories we're reporting about the effects of Russia's invasion.
But right now, Ari Shapiro says he has just one goal for all the different aspects of his work.
Whether I am singing to a live audience of thousands or broadcasting on the radio to somebody, you know, sitting alone in their driveway, I want to give somebody a reason to keep listening.
Thank you for listening. Please join us when our trumpet sounds again next Sunday morning.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to CBS Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.